Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2009 and Ruination, the early years.
So, in April 2009, a pioneer of digital broadcasting celebrated his monumental 300th daily broadcast. And, you know, he didn't do it by popping champagne or bringing on a parade of celebrity guests.
Right, which you would totally expect for a milestone like that.
Exactly. Instead, he did it by eating rancid office popcorn and during a violent gastrointestinal crisis at his day job, and somehow turning that very physical misery into the primary source material for a college academic term paper.
It is just a staggering contrast. I mean, you have this medium in its infancy where creators are scrambling to look professional and slick, and here is someone doing the exact opposite.
Yeah, he really is.
He is building an entire digital empire, not out of polish, but out of the mundane, highly unvarnished friction of daily life.
I am your host, King.
And I am your host, Gail.
Welcome to Rumination, the early years. Our mission for today's deep dive into the source material is to really explore the daily life, the bizarre stories, and the unfiltered chaos of the big fatty online universe during the month of April 2009. We are looking at a digital landscape that is chaotic, entirely unpredictable, and oddly profound.
That duality is exactly what makes April 2009 such a fascinating case study for you to listen to. We are examining how a creator can be so wildly irreverent, basically flying by the seat of his pants, while also commanding an audience that literally studies his broadcasting habits for college credit.
It's wild. So let's look at how he sets the tone for this milestone month, because he begins it with aggressive, deliberate sabotage.
Oh, totally deliberate.
Right. On April Fool's Day, he actively disrupts his own meticulously crafted daily routine. Instead of the normal welcome, he drops a broadcast that actively confuses the audience, pretending the show has been replaced by something called the Lesbian Fart Squeak Show.
I mean, the audio for this is just jarring. He plays these strange, highly distorted, reversed audio clips, followed by a bizarre fake song about a PHLL fool, which is, you know, play on April Fool.
Yeah.
It is absolute auditory whiplash.
And to really grasp why this prank worked so well, you have to remember the mechanical reality of consuming digital audio back in 2009. I mean, we didn't have instant cloud streaming.
Not at all.
I honestly think of this prank as a form of early 2000s digital hostage taking.
Oh, that is a great way to describe the technology of the era. Walk us through that friction a bit.
Well, think about the physical effort required for you, the listener. Back then, you had to boot up a desktop computer, open iTunes, and, you know, manually download a heavy MP3 file over a spotty broadband connection.
Which took forever.
Exactly. Then you had to physically connect your iPod with one of those wide 30-pin cables. You waited for it to sync, you safely ejected the device, and then you got in your car to drive to work.
Yeah, a huge production just to listen to something.
Right, and Big Fatty knew that because of all that effort, you were essentially tracked. If you were driving down the highway when that fake Lesbian Fart Squeak Show started playing, you couldn't just tap a touch screen to swipe to the next thing.
You couldn't just skip it.
No, you were a captive audience, entirely held hostage to his audio experiment for your commute.
He literally weaponized the technological friction of the era to force you to endure the joke.
Yeah.
And the way he handles the immediate aftermath is just as telling, because the very next day, April 2nd, is episode 300.
A huge deal.
Yeah, in independent media, making it to 300 consecutive daily shows is a massive logistical achievement. So how does he handle the triumph? He shrugs.
He just brushes it off.
He literally gets on the mic and explicitly tells the audience that it's, quote, not really a big deal.
Which is wild, because the contrast between his nonchalance and the community's sheer dedication is just staggering. He brushes it off, but his listeners are proving just how deeply embedded he is in their physical lives.
Oh, for sure.
Take the listener named Nessa. She calls in to recount how her custom Big Fatty online cell phone ringtone, which, by the way, is an audio clip of him just aggressively yelling prank party, went off while she was sitting in a nail salon.
Oh, no.
Yes, it completely startled her Korean manicurist to the point of ruining the manicure.
That is amazing. And then there's listener Bill in St. Louis, who calls in to congratulate him. Bill holds the prestigious title of the show's number one fan. And how was that decided?
Oh, I know this one.
His name was drawn from a metaphorical colostomy bag during a bizarre contest.
A colostomy bag? I mean, I have to admit, when you look at that dynamic, it seems completely counterintuitive. Why is an audience so dedicated to a creator who treats his own milestones like an annoyance?
Well, it comes down to intimacy, I think. By treating episode 300 like just another mundane Thursday, he reinforces the idea that this isn't a performance, it's a conversation.
Right.
A polished anniversary special creates distance between the host and the audience. Downplaying it makes the listener feel like they're just hanging out with a friend.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And while he might dismiss professional milestones, he definitely does not dismiss holidays, especially when those holidays involve food.
Definitely not.
Which brings us to the culinary indulgence of April and the biological consequences that become prime source material.
Oh boy. His tracking of mundane food deals this month is practically an Olympic sport. The archives detail his intense fixation on hunting down BOGO buy one, get one free bacon at the grocery store.
The BOGO bacon.
Yes. And he also gives a hyper-detailed on-air review of Chick-fil-A's new spicy chicken sandwich, which, you know, was only available in test markets in California and Baltimore at the time.
Right. But he does draw a line when things get too extreme. A listener sends him an article about a culinary monstrosity called the turbicken ducking.
That was?
The turbicken ducking, which is a chicken stuffed inside a duck, stuffed inside a turkey, all entirely wrapped in bacon.
That sounds revolting.
He reacts with genuine physical disgust. So, you know, he does have boundaries with his meat consumption.
Barely. Because his post-holiday rituals are incredibly intense. The Monday after Easter, he is just stalking the grocery aisles for half-price discounted candy. And his celebration for April 20th, 420, is hilariously wholesome. Instead of partaking in traditional counterculture activities, he marks the occasion by treating himself to a slice of pineapple upside-down cake.
With the pecan right in the center, he paints such a vivid picture of these indulgences. But this relentless snacking eventually catches up with him. And this leads us to the infamous popcorn disaster at the coal mine.
The coal mine being his cynical nickname for his day job.
Right, exactly. So he admits on air that he found some leftover popcorn from a machine at the office over the weekend. He eats a massive bucket of it, and the results are catastrophic.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah, he experiences severe, undeniable gastrointestinal distress. And because it is 2009, you know, the global news cycle is dominated by the H1N1 virus. So his immediate hypochondriac fear is that this stale office popcorn has somehow given him the swine flu.
Wow. Jumping right to the worst case scenario.
And he spends the entire week updating you on his digestive tract. He openly admits to releasing silent but deadly fumes, SBDs, in his office cubicle, basically terrorizing his coworkers.
I genuinely don't understand the instinct to broadcast that. A normal person gets sick from office popcorn, takes a sick day, and goes dark. Why overshare to that degree?
Well, because of how he pivots. He doesn't just complain. He turns the misery into architecture.
Okay, what do you mean by that?
He takes this physical distress and uses it to launch a brand new recurring show segment called Blowing It Out.
Oh, that is brilliant.
Right. Rather than taking time off, he takes his literal biological venting, pairs it with his metaphorical workplace venting, and creates a structured, interactive audio feature.
So he involves the audience.
Exactly. He invites the audience to leave voicemails blowing out their own frustrations. He effectively monetizes his own misery by creating a space for communal catharsis.
It levels the playing field completely. By weaponizing his own biological vulnerability, he removes any pretense. And the bizarre side effect of this grotesque transparency about his digestion is that it actually elevates him.
Mm.
He doesn't lose credibility by talking about cubicle flatulence. He becomes a deeply trusted authority figure.
Which is the perfect catalyst for a massive shift we see this month. The community's reliance on him leads to the formalization of the Ask Big Fatty segment.
Yeah, listeners start treating him like a hybrid of an agony aunt and a lifestyle guru.
Totally.
They write in with highly specific questions, ranging from how to properly clean leather gear to the absolute best way to bake a pound cake.
I have to express some skepticism here, though. Why on earth would anyone ask the guy who just gave himself rancid popcorn diarrhea for baking advice?
It's the parasocial trust mechanism in action. When a creator is willing to tell you the most embarrassing, unvarnished truth about their own failings, you inherently trust that they won't lie to you about anything else.
Okay, I see that.
If he gives you a pound cake recipe, you know it's not a sponsored corporate talking point. It's genuine.
That makes total sense. And that trust really culminates in the triumphant return of a listener named Puff Freddy.
Oh, right. Puff Freddy had vanished from the community for 7 weeks to marry his husband, Jed.
Yeah, but he doesn't just call in to say hello. He is taking a college speech class, and he has decided to use Big Fatty as the primary subject for an academic term paper about independent digital media.
So the man we just heard detailing his digestive issues in a cubicle is now the subject of collegiate study. Puff Freddy conducts a formal interview on the air.
And he genuinely delivers. He answers these academic questions with remarkable depth. He explains the origin of his nom de plume, detailing how long he's cultivated this persona.
He really opens up.
He does. He recounts the foundational early days of recording the Little Fatty Cast with his former co-host, Larry Vader.
And he also lays out his strict philosophy on audience retention. He tells Puff Freddy that if you are producing a daily show, you have exactly 1 week to hook a new listener.
One week.
Yeah. If they aren't emotionally invested after 5 episodes, they never will be.
You know, I am going to push back hard on anyone who casually writes him off as just an internet shock jock.
Oh, absolutely.
It is so easy to listen to the fart jokes and the reversed audio April Fool's pranks and assume he is just flying blind. But when you listen to that term paper interview, he is operating like an early digital sociologist.
That's a great way to put it.
He articulates a highly self-aware, deeply considered defense of independent, uncensored media. He knows exactly why his lack of a corporate filter matters to you, the listener. He understands the mechanics of intimacy in a digital space better than most marketing executives did in 2009.
Well, he is incredibly self-aware about the insulated bubble he has created. But because of his rigid daily broadcasting schedule, he doesn't have the luxury of just staying inside that bubble.
No, he doesn't.
He is constantly forced to consume the outside world, the daily news cycle, pop culture, just to have fresh material to talk about. And the way those real-world events collide with his specific lens in April 2009 is fascinating.
The collisions are spectacular. Let's look at Tax Day on April 15th. Now, just to be perfectly clear for you, the listener, we're looking at this strictly through Big Fatty's irreverent perspective.
Yes, very important caveat.
We aren't taking any political stances on the 2009 protests, left or right. We are just observing how he processed the media coverage without endorsing any viewpoints.
Exactly. Because when Big Fatty watches Rachel Maddow's coverage of the political protests on Tax Day, he isn't captivated by the tax policy or the partisan
At
divide.
all.
He is entirely captivated by the news anchor's straight-faced, repeated use of the word teabagging to describe the protests.
It's hilarious. He plays the audio clip of the news broadcast on his show, just marveling at the double entendre.
You can't believe it.
He cannot get over the fact that mainstream cable news is repeatedly using a highly specific piece of adult slang with complete deadpan seriousness. He processes a moment of national political unrest purely through the lens of inappropriate linguistic humor.
But the humor vanishes entirely when a different protest intersects directly with his own medium. April 17th, 2009 was the National Day of Silence, which was a protest intended to bring attention to anti-LGBTQ bullying. Many independent creators in his network observe the day by literally staying silent and choosing not to publish.
But Big Fatty doesn't.
No, he completely ignores the protest. He turns on a microphone and broadcasts a regular, highly chatty, business-as-usual recording.
And the backlash he gets for that is swift. He receives severe criticism from a prominent community site called The Daily Mic.
They were not happy.
No, they are furious that he spent 20 minutes of a solemn day just calling out listeners who hadn't emailed him recently. And the community twists the knife by comparing him to his arch rival, Auntie Vera, who he refers to as the sea hag because she also broke the silence and published.
Oh, wow. Being compared to the sea hag is the ultimate insult in this universe.
It really is.
You know, it is easy to view his refusal to participate as insensitive. But I want you to consider the psychology of a daily audio diarist for a moment. For a creator who has meticulously built a daily 20-minute structural container to hold his life together, the compulsion to broadcast is his anchor. His voice is the tether connecting him to thousands of people.
That makes sense.
Asking someone that deeply entrenched in a daily routine to stay silent for a day isn't just asking him to observe a protest. It is effectively asking him to stop breathing. The broadcast is his life support.
That is a really profound way to look at it. He simply cannot exist in the digital space without making noise, and he applies that same continuous noise to his processing of pop culture throughout the month, too.
Oh, yeah.
He's heavily invested in reality television, boldly predicting that Adam Lambert is going to win American Idol.
He also goes on a deep tangent reminiscing about childhood memories of watching Ernest Angley, the infamous televangelist he calls the hitting preacher.
Hitting preacher.
Yeah, he recounts how the man would smack people on the forehead, yelling, "Come in, Jesus."
But his pop culture coverage takes a very somber, meaningful turn at the end of the month with the passing of television legend B. Arthur.
The death of a Golden Girls star is a massive emotional event for this specific demographic. He mourns her passing on the air, celebrating her strength, her caftans, and her legacy.
And think about why that matters. Grieving a celebrity together, even someone they never met, creates a moment of genuine communal emotion amidst all the rancid popcorn stories and teabagging jokes.
It grounds the show.
It reinforces that bond. When you process grief alongside someone, even digital grief, they stop feeling like an entertainer and start feeling like a fixture in your life.
So what does this all mean when we look at the big picture of April 2009? It stands as a masterclass in how a digital creator utilizes friction.
Mm-hmm.
He takes the mundane friction of daily life, stale coal mine popcorn, coupon math, college term papers, and TV recaps, and he uses it as mortar. He builds a fiercely loyal, totally unvarnished universe by simply allowing his audience to witness his daily existence.
He proves that you don't need a polished corporate strategy to build an empire. You just need the willingness to be entirely unapologetically yourself, flaws, boundaries, and digestive issues included.
And that leaves you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to ponder as we close the archives for today.
Let's hear.
If an audience becomes so emotionally invested in a creator that they incorporate a stranger's screaming ringtone into their physical daily lives and analyze his bathroom habits and broadcasting philosophies for college credit, at what point does a digital broadcast cease to be mere entertainment and actually become a surrogate family?
It is a blurry line, and April 2009 proves just how easily it can be crossed. I am King.
And I am Gabe.
We invite you to come back next Saturday for another month of Ruination, the early years.
And don't forget to tune in each Sunday for Ruination Repeat, which recaps last week's current BFO episodes. We'll see you then.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination, the early years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.